Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Autism Stories. I'm your host, Doug Butcher, the founder of Autism Personal Coach. Autistic people are the true experts of the autistic experience, and Autism Stories is where we interview autistic people to learn from their stories, experiences, and get their insights. If you would like to be notified about each week's episode of Autism Stories, we suggest you subscribe on your favorite podcast listening platform. We would also appreciate it if you could give us a positive rating and review, as it will help others to learn about autism stories. On today's episode, Marissa Hamamoto joins us to discuss her dance company that employs disabled and non-disabled dancers, being a stroke survivor, and artistic roller skating. We hope you enjoy today's conversation. Marissa, thanks so much for joining me here on Autism Stories.
Thank you so much, Doug, for having me.
I'd love to start off our conversation by learning, where does your story in the autistic community begin?
That is a really good question. It begins in multiple places, I would say, but I'll say this much, that since as long as I can remember, I never fit the box. Let me start with that. I was diagnosed with autism at 40, and I'm 42 now. So I was diagnosed with autism kind of in midlife here. Never knew what autism was until maybe a few years ago. But looking back, I've always felt like I never fit in. And I know that many autistics feel that way. Now I have a name to put this uniqueness to it. I would say that's the short story. Long story short, I am best known as the founder of Infinite Flow, which is a dance company that employs disabled and non-disabled dancers with diverse intersectional identities. And you know, we use dance as a catalyst to advocate for disability inclusion. I started Infinite Flow in 2015. And, you know, the brief story behind, I guess, well, let's just say the story that's best told about my origin story for Infinite Flow is that I'm a stroke survivor. So I had a stroke while in college, and then years later built Infinite Flow. However, 6-7 years into running this dance company, and as I got to learn more about neurodiversity along the path of becoming a or being a disability inclusion leader, I would say, I started to feel that I was checking a lot of boxes for autism. And so then I got assessed. And surely enough, I'm autistic. And the world didn't fall apart. So, yes.
Now, I don't think that we can really understand the autistic experience without talking about intersectionality. And you mentioned that you being a stroke survivor. So I'm wondering if there are ways that being a stroke survivor has impacted your autistic experience.
Well, more than a stroke survivor, I would say being Asian American, being fourth generation Japanese American, born between a third generation Japanese American father from Hawaii and a Japanese mother. So blood wise, I'm fully Japanese, but my parents are like coming from two very different Japanese worlds. You know, kind of my Japanese and Japanese American identity has definitely influenced a lot about I would say even just acknowledging or even just getting assessed. I think in the Asian American community, especially here in America, you know, where in which, you know, I think Asian Americans who've immigrated here, there's just so much pressure to do well in school and to get a certain type of degree and, you know, become a doctor, become a lawyer. Like there's so much emphasis on achievement academically. That there is a lot of ableism. Like, I think there's a lot of shame amongst Asian families for any type of disability, including autism. I think that has affected me. Now, full transparency, I don't think my parents knew about autism growing up. For me, like, I look back at my childhood, there was many signs of being autistic. For example, Like I was always having a lot of social anxiety. Like I had no problems raising my hand in class when I knew the answer. But when it came to the lunch tables, it was very difficult for me to connect with people. I had a huge, pretty big betrayal incident at school when I was a freshman in high school. And for maybe the neurotypical child, they might get a little upset, recover, maybe talk to that friend that betrayed. But in my case, I completely shut down. I didn't want to return to school. I convinced my parents that I just want to homeschool. And I was so strong about that I won. I won. They let, you know, they, you know, there's no way of like changing my opinion. So in a way, like some of us autistics do become really strong activists and advocates. And I think that was maybe the beginning of it. I had noise sensitivity. My earliest of where I was like, ooh, this was not fun was so I started dancing when I was 5/6, you know, ballet. And then I tried tap dancing when I was maybe 7 or 8. And and it was, I remember it was like a summer, like 6-week course type of a thing. So six tap classes. And I think like my head was just throbbing every week in tap class from the taps being so loud. And it was just echoing through my body. And I would get a headache. And then I would go to my mom and just start crying, saying, I don't feel well. And then finally, I think after week 4 or 5, my mom was like, you know what? If this is giving you so much pain, then you don't need to do this, you know? So that was like maybe my earliest memory of noise sensitivity. But going back to, you know, your question about intersectionality, I definitely do believe that how our other identities and lived experiences intersect with autism does play a big role. And in my case, I think it's also like this is also a little generational, which I think there's more awareness around autism among Asian American families now than when I was growing up, like 20, 30 years ago. Well, I'm sorry, 30, 40 years ago. How old am I right now? However, I'll say as a now 9-year disability inclusion leader that has gotten a decent amount of media and traction, sometimes I do feel left out in the Asian American community. And I think it's because the nature of the work I do is not like it's not like Hollywood movie star, you know, it's disability inclusion. So we have a lot of work to do.
Yeah, like when I meet people and you know they ask you what you do, and I'll tell them an entrepreneur, they're interested, and then I tell them what my business is specifically about. It's almost like they take 3 steps back energetically wise, and those conversations kind of start to drift away.
Yeah, I really commend you for putting autism into your kind of coaching title. For me, like the moment you reached out, I'm like, yes. Like I didn't have to like even like read too much about you, because even the fact that you're putting that word into your title, that okay, I'm gonna jive with Doug. No, because it is a bold statement. It is. I mean, I think in our maybe in our little autism neurodivergent bubble, like disability community bubble, you know, autism, talking about autism, it has become, I would say, a more of a everyday thing now. But you step outside of this bubble, the stigma is real. Like it is real. Like I was a leader for disability inclusion for 6, 7 years, and you know, like literally, trying to break, my work was around destigmatizing disability. Yet when I was diagnosed with autism, I couldn't come out saying that I was autistic for months. And that was actually when I really had to sit with my own ableism and go, okay, we need to just look at our ableist beliefs here. So there was a little bit of a lot of unlearning and just, you know, kind of unraveling all this bias that I actually had, you know. And I would say I'm still going through it, even though I've become very open to talking about autism.
Now, you mentioned Infinite Flow earlier, and I love talking with other entrepreneurs. And, you know, for you, from a blank slate with no seed money, you created Infinite Flow Dance, an award-winning nonprofit dance company that employs disabled and non-disabled dancers with diverse intersectional identities, with a mission to use dance as a catalyst to dismantle biases and foster inclusion.
What can you? That's a lot of words.
That is. I needed them in front of me to read. Otherwise, I would not have. I would have stumbled for sure.
We need to fix that.
No, it's wonderful. What would be your advice to other people that have a small amount of money in starting their entrepreneurial journeys?
I would say, first of all, it's possible to start anything wherever you are. Like, it doesn't have to be entrepreneurial. Like, my side hustle, in this case, this side hustle project became a business. Did I have aspirations for that? Yeah, but, you know, it was kind of like, let's run an experiment. Experiment meaning, hey, let's just do one event. Let's see what happens. Let's see what the traction is. And so I would say my advice is, you know, if there is a burning desire to build a business, go into entrepreneurship, and there's a clear why, you know, you're so passionate about the why that you are going to do it no matter what. If there is a clear why for that and you're truly passionate, you know, start with what you have and where you're at within the resources that you do have, and be creative and start somewhere, I would say. Yeah, like, I think in my case, I basically was like, okay, what resources do I have? What do I have access to? I'd had this burning desire, or this, you know, I just knew it. It was my destiny to do something at the intersection of dance and disability. And I saw a gap. More than anything, I saw a gap. I was like, wow, I didn't know that 1 in 4 Americans had a disability, and that's 61 million Americans. But I've been dancing my whole life. And when was the last time I heard about disabled people dancing? I mean, you know, so I knew that there was a gap, and it was not. And as someone who believes that everybody should dance and everybody should act, well, maybe everybody should have access to dance, I just didn't think it was right for someone not to have access to dance. And so that was part of why I, you know, I just had this burning desire. If I were to share a little bit more about the origin story, you know, so I became interested in this idea of wheelchair dance as a stroke survivor. And as I was doing some exploration and within that journey, I met a paraplegic athlete by the name of Adolfo. I was just like interested in just seeing what it was to dance with him. And so I literally messaged him on you know, Facebook, and was like, hey, you want to try dancing? I'm a stroke survivor. I'm exploring this concept around dance and disability. Would you like to meet me? And we just experimentally dance. And strangely and surprisingly, he said, yeah. And so we met in a dance studio a couple of days later. And honestly, I was scared to dance with Adolfo. You know, I didn't know what it was like to dance with someone who couldn't walk using a wheelchair. So I had my own biases. I had my own, like, fears. And but 2 hours into dancing with him, like, I realized that dancing with Adolfo was nothing different from dancing with anyone else. And that was when I realized that, you know, when you're dancing with someone, you see beyond things like race, color, size, age, gender, sexual orientation, disability. And I truly felt like, well, if the world danced, there would be no war. And now, I have a slightly different opinion on the war part, but at that time, you know, I really felt like, you know, if we can dance together, we can better connect with one another. And I really saw this world dancing together, and, you know, really thought that, you know, like, dance can save the world. And so that kind of breakthrough moment was just so strong in me that I had to act on it. And let's ring a bell here, special interest, this pursuit of dance and disability, like, of getting disabled and non-disabled dancers dancing together. This became an intense special interest, like, night and day. This is all I was thinking about, you know, even during my, at that time, my day job. My day job was also like a self-run business, self-run, dance instruction business. But I could not, it's like the moment I decided this is what I'm going to do, it was it. There's like no way of like turning back around.
How can our listeners learn more about you and Infinite Flow Dance beyond this interview?
So you can follow me on Instagram or LinkedIn at Marissa Hamamoto or at Infinite Flow Dance. I would say, you know, if you do Google my name, you'll find a bunch of, you know, whether it's podcast interviews, you'll find my website. Yeah, I think just Google my name, you'll find something. But yeah, the best I would say is, especially in the last year, I've become more consistent with creating content, focused on autism and disability inclusion. So LinkedIn and Instagram are kind of the places where I put that content out right now. YouTube channel coming, but one thing at a time. We don't have to do everything at once.
Now, movement must be a really important part of your life because beyond dance, you took up roller skating during the pandemic. Why did you decide to take up roller skating and like in what ways has it impacted your life?
Roller skating came into my life about a year into the pandemic in which I was having a mental health breakdown. This was a combination of feeling like my business was falling apart. My career was kind of falling apart. You know, my dad had passed right before the pandemic due to cancer. And I was grieving about that a year later. Like I think after my dad passed, the first few months was, or the first 3 or 4 months was literally me taking care of family affairs and just helping my mom out, you know. And then the pandemic hit, and then it became about surviving the pandemic. And so literally, I think it was a year into the pandemic where the grief around losing my father, you know, came. And so between that, the business, Stop Asian Hate uprisings were kind of all happening. And that was just very triggering. And I was also dealing with my own kind of like, just reliving some of these things I've dealt with as an Asian American, confronting them, but also forgiving them. And so between that and also at the same time, being named People Magazine Women Changing the World, which was a huge honor, but there was a huge gap between the honor, the recognition, and how I was really feeling. And that gap just really took me down. And when it took me down, I had to ask myself, we need to shift this. Like, you know, we need to, the fact that I was so, there was such a big contrast. And so in that mental health breakdown, I knew I had to find something that was going to bring me joy, but also take my mind off of everything. So by accident, I started roller skating. There was a few dancers and people around me who had started to skate. And somehow I was really drawn into that idea. And surely enough, roller skating at first was very, very scary. But the act of balancing on wheels became a movement meditation practice. You know, it was also like where I realized like I was seeking for something that was kinesthetically stimulating and challenging. And roller skating provided that. I mean, if I were to relate this to my autism, I think, you know, whether it's stimming or there was this like this, you know, there was these like sensory needs that really needed to be attended to. And so it fulfilled that kind of part of me that was just kind of missing that part.
I'm interested, you mentioned it in terms of movement meditation. Now, I meditate on a daily basis each morning, but I've heard, you know, a lot of times I'll hear people say, oh, meditation's not for me. So can you talk a little bit about movement meditation for...
Yeah. You know, for me, you know, meditation is focusing on one thing, like one thing or being present And being present oftentimes is focusing on the present, focusing on what is happening here and now. So like in the Zen was maybe the first type of meditation that I learned, or I tried to learn. Maybe I shouldn't say I learned. I was exposed to, but you know, that the first thing that we were taught was to look at one spot on the wall. You know, and oh my gosh, my first meditation experience literally was at a monastery in Japan. We literally talk about this was not very accessible, but we literally sat on our knees, you know, and we literally stared at a spot. And if we started to slouch, yeah, literally the monk would come to like kind of slap you, with, not like hard, but he would kind of like tap you. And so anyways, that was my first experience with meditation. I tried it a few times and I'm like, okay, this is not for me. But putting that aside, but the concept over, you know, the staring at one thing made me realize, oh, okay, meditation is about kind of focusing on one thing and staying present. That was the whole point. So movement, you know, can't be meditative. For me, and this is might be me, this might be others, when I'm actually learning a new skill in as a mover, so whether that's dance, skating, when I'm being challenged to just learn a new skill and I have to focus, that gets me to focus on one thing and be present. And roller skating, especially when you're starting off, yeah, you either pay attention or you are going to fall. And either way, you are going to fall. So just having to focus, like, you know, on what you are doing is it's a huge meditative practice.
Now, lastly, now this might seem like quite a strange transition. I want to talk about avocado toast with you.
Yeah.
This has become it seems apparently it's my new food. I'm apparently eating it every day. The weird thing is I didn't even know, like, this, I guess, I don't know if this is embarrassing or not. Being 45 years old, didn't know when avocados became ripe or not, like how to eat them. So I'm asking you this because a couple weeks ago on social media, you mentioned that this is something for you as well that you eat often. So I want to know, how do you prepare this and how much do sensory and executive functioning differences impact you, maybe just overall when you eat avocado toast or anything else?
Yeah, so I go through periods of having, you know, the same foods. And, you know, like right now, I've moved from avocado toast to cheese toast, for example.
Okay.
So it's where, like, once I find, like, a comfort food that nourishes me and gives me energy, gets me through the morning or the day, it's like I'll stick with that for a while. Or I'll have a combination of, I'll have avocado toast one day, cheese toast another day, and then peanut butter toast another day. Like, so I'll find, like, these comfort foods and then we'll repeat them. For me, you know, avocado toast, like, for me, like, it was just where... What I do find, at least for, and again, this is just me personally, for breakfast, I just in context of this, I do roller skate at 6 a.m. in the morning, as you know, I'm part of artistic training, a skating club. And so before I go to the rink, I usually eat something light, like maybe a few crackers or like a piece of fruit. Like, it's not really a breakfast. It's more to just, you know, just so that I'm fully empty. So then it's after skating that I usually have a real breakfast. For me, I do know from my own just experimentation with food and knowing myself that, you know, having healthy fats, you know, and protein is kind of really important, as well as carbs too. So the balance between healthy fats, protein, and carbs is more, I would say, more healthy fats than anything else to just kind of keep my blood sugar down and keep me going is something that I've noticed helps me. So that's where the avocado toast came in. It's very easy in terms of what I do with the avocado toast. It's not so complicated. That's why, like, when I'm at some restaurant and they're charging like $15 for avocado toast. I'm like, ooh. You know, I mean, avocados are a little expensive, and so it's not the cheapest of things. But basically, I cut an avocado in half. I take the seed out. I take one side of the avocado. I take a fork and I just literally just mush the green kind of avocado meat like until it's soft. Like I'm someone that tries to minimize the amount of time I clean and I wash dishes, and so I try to accomplish this besides like a cutting board to cut the avocado in half. And even that too, I don't even need a cutting board anymore. I've learned to cut an avocado in half, you know, using just a knife. But anyway, I just mush that. Trader Joe's has this everything but the bagel seasoning. And so I put that in there. I kind of mix it together and I put it on my toast. Very, very easy. No butter, no other oils. And I believe I got this recipe off of Instagram, which I don't think I saved, but it was so easy that I was like, oh, okay, that's easy. I can do that. You know, that doesn't require a lot of cooking time. But bringing this back to autism, this concept around, you know, eating the same foods every day where I can, or at least two meals, like at least for breakfast, maybe for lunch, trying to eat the same thing every day, trying to, I tend to repeat wearing the same clothes almost every week. And then occasionally I'm like, okay, we need a new outfit here and there. Or if it's a special occasion, I'll have my special occasion, you know, clothes. But this kind of idea around routine was something that was already in me before my diagnosis. And then it was after my diagnosis that I realized that, oh, wow, some of this like routine stuff that I have already in my life, which I thought I was kind of a weirdo for doing that. Oh, this is just part of regulating my autism, in the sense that it gives a degree of predictability and like some safety. And it's just so that I can focus on other things that are not predictable at times. So I don't know. That's what I'm learning. But what's your take on that? Do you see this common trend among your clients and yourself of just trying to find routines?
Yeah, definitely. And even like in terms of clothing, I've realized in the last year or two, like, I don't really want to wear jeans anymore. Why do I wear those? And it's just, they're not comfortable. So I'm wearing a lot more softer clothing, and once I'm finding like a material that I really like, I'm just buying it in different colors.
Yeah. And, you know, and honestly, I don't think it's just an autistic thing to do some of these things, but it's just more common among autistics, I think, is what it is. You know, I truly believe that, like, you know, disability inclusion benefits everyone. So if we talk about clothing, you know, fabrics that are soft, that are kind of like sensory friendly, I mean, usually these fabrics become good for everyone. There's just fabrics that are like just nice to wear. So yeah, and I'm a little bit, I would say, any shirts that become even a little bit itchy, no, get them away. So I do appreciate when brands do make an effort to just make sure that their clothes, period, you know, are sensory friendly, because I think it's good for everyone.
Yeah, and in terms of routines, to me, it's like, yeah, I can adjust, and I can adjust my routine. I can be, you know, flexible or whatever someone's definition of that is. But to me, it's about processing, you know, and anytime I can reduce the amount of thought of decisions, you know, throughout my day, it just reduces my anxiety and, you know, my routines go a lot better. And, you know, I have like a morning routine. I have an afternoon routine.
Yeah.
I have a night routine. I have a sleep routine. So, it's critical for me to go about my day, especially as an entrepreneur, when there's so many different moving parts throughout the day. It's essential for me.
I agree. I agree. I really ag agree with that. I do like routine. I tend to gravitate towards, for example, when it comes to movement and dance and roller skating. With roller skating, the moment I discovered artistic roller skating and realized how structured it was, I was like, oh, this is for me. I tend, as a dancer, I started off with ballet, which is very highly structured and syllabus oriented. I loved it. Went into ballroom dancing. It was where we went when I entered the category of contemporary dance, where I was like, okay, wow, this is a little bit all over the map here. And that in itself, I try to find routine, And what's interesting is, because I was having a conversation with someone else today about this, where, we can find creativity and play within these structured activities. Just because it's structured doesn't mean that it's rigid and it's not fun. We find the fun and the play within the structure. And in fact, the structure allows us to be safe, to have fun. So, one thing that's, I think, in my autistic journey, in addition to people DMing me, texting me, in my autism journey, I don't, and I would love to hear a little bit from you about this. Do you notice more undiagnosed autistics around you since you started your coaching business?
I think, well, yes, but I think even more so once I understood more about my own autism and understood more like why I do this thing and that thing. And like every day, I'm like, it seems like over these last like few years, like I'm uncovering like how this particular supposed random thing relates to my autistic experience. And it's just like so easy, I guess, the pattern recognition to see that in other people.
Yeah, and I thankfully, I think on my first week after I got diagnosed, I listened to a YouTube video, which I wish I can figure out whose it was, but basically he gave advice about you're going to start to notice a lot of people around you to be autistic, but please do not go up to that person and say, "Hey, I think you're autistic," because you don't know that person and what their perceptions of autism is. And thank goodness I heard that advice because, I feel like I identify. I'm like, okay, I think so and so has undiagnosed autism. We're gonna breathe through what just happened, because I can see myself in the other person's tendency, which for the neurotypical person, it's like, whoa, what was that? But for me, I'm like, okay, I've been there before, So, yeah.
And I think the other thing about that is that I think as part of the autistic experience, there's a lot of trauma related to that. So when you're walking up to someone that most likely is autistic, if you've identified it, they probably are. I think it's you can trigger them in some ways that they may not be ready to acknowledge. Well, Marissa, it was a pleasure to get to know you. Thanks so much for taking the time to join me here on Autism Stories.
Well, thank you so much, Doug, for having me. And let's stay connected.
Thanks so much to Marissa for the conversation. To learn more about Marissa and her dance company, check out the link in the podcast description for this episode. We always love hearing from you and would especially love to hear from you relating to this episode on what physical activities keep you grounded and bring you joy. Here at Autism Personal Coach, our clients are the experts, our coaches are the guides. The majority of supports for autistics are not helpful. They try to fix us, not support us. That's why many are confused when we say our clients are the experts, experts of their lived experience. Our clients are the experts for what has worked for them and about the things they need and want in their lives. Our coaches first listen to our clients, then ask thoughtful questions, offer resources, and strategize with our clients so they can get what they need to thrive. Would you want a guide in your life to coach you to help you get the things you desire? If so, then visit autismpersonalcoach.com for more information. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Autism Stories. And if you did, if you could tell a friend, foe, or anyone else you know about it, so they could have the same enjoyable and educational experience as you when listening to Autism Stories, it would be very much appreciated. Until next time, I'm Doug Bletcher of Autism Personal Coach. Talk to you then.